right, well, we'll begin with a bit of review. We are in chapter 9 of Daniel. The first part of the chapter told us about Daniel reading the scriptures that had been written, and then he prayed about them. He read primarily from the prophet Jeremiah, but there were others that he read as well. And in that book, God decreed that the Babylonian captivity would last for 70 years. While this corresponded to the number of Sabbath years that the Israelites had neglected to rest while they first came into the land that God promised them. God said the land would enjoy its Sabbaths eventually, even if it meant that Israel would be removed from the land and dispersed to other nations. Well, Daniel recognized that those 70 years were almost at an end. As a result, much of Daniel's prayer is a confession for his sins and the sins of his people. He confesses that they have done wrong and disobeyed God. Daniel then prays that God would remember his promise to his people. He appeals to God's character. He does not want God's name defamed among the people or the onlooking heathen nations. He asks that God would make his face to shine upon his people. He is concerned for the glory of God and the sake of his name. Well, then last week we saw that God sent Gabriel to answer Daniel's prayer. Gabriel told Daniel that he received the command to go down, quote, at the beginning of your supplication. So God was answering Daniel's prayer before he even finished calling on God. And this is what God does in answering our prayers as well, before we finished asking. We said that we'll approach this section, called by some as the backbone of Bible prophecy, by trying to make plain sense of what the text says. There is some symbolism here, but when there's a clear meaning, we won't look for another. Gabriel told Daniel that 77s, or seven periods of 7 years, had been decreed and would be completed. Gabriel listed 6 things that would be accomplished during this period. They're listed as follows in the second half of verse 24 that we reviewed them last week. They'll finish the transgression, put an end to sin, atone for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal both vision and prophet, and anoint a most holy place. And we said the first 3 accomplishments involve dealing with human rebellion in all its forms, whether it's transgression or sin or iniquity, using different words for different variations of that sin. Jesus provided the solution at the cross with his once-for-all atoning death, but the ultimate elimination of sin awaits his second coming. This prophecy looks to Christ in both his first and second coming. Now, the second 3 accomplishments that were listed there complete God's plan and bring righteousness to his people. Daniel's prayer was concerning the deliverance of his people out of Babylon in that captivity. God's concern was Israel's deliverance from a much greater bondage than was the bondage to sin. That deliverance will be accomplished through the work of Christ in his first and second coming. Well, tonight we're going to continue to look at the 77s of the prophecy. So let me read again. We'll backtrack a little bit all the way back to verse 20 so that we get in the whole part of this section. We'll read to 27, and if you'll just note any important words there, we'll do that for our overview tonight. All right, Daniel 9, verse 20. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my plea before Yahweh my God for the holy hill of my God, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. He made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out, and I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week. And for half of the week, he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate, until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. Okay. So what are some important words there?
A lot of desolation.
A lot of desolation, yeah. A lot of sevens.
Understand.
Yeah.
Your great love.
Your great love?
Great love.
I missed the set.
You are greatly loved.
Oh, you are not.
Messiah the Prince.
I'm sorry? Okay, great. Well, verse 25 says that Daniel is to know and discern. This reinforces the words that Gabriel spoke when he began his explanation in verse 23. There he said that Daniel should consider the word and understand the vision. Gabriel was telling Daniel to become intimately familiar with the words he was about to speak. The prophecy is difficult and takes some work to understand, but it is understandable. As you may know, a few differing explanations have been given for these verses. And as we mentioned last week, we're going to be literal, grammatical, and historical. So we're also going to humbly seek to make plain sense out of this prophecy. Gabriel gives us a time frame and sets the beginning point as the going out of the word to reinforce and rebuild Jerusalem. So this beginning point is important to our understanding of the passage. Scripture mentions 4 decrees that take place around this general time, and we'll review what they are, and they come into play for different people in their viewing of what this time frame is all about. So the first one is the decree of Cyrus. I think we've touched on this a couple times in our study, but it's when Cyrus allows some of the Jews to go back and rebuild the temple. So somebody has 2 Chronicles 36, 22, and 23.
Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all those people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up.
Okay, so that's the first decree that some people consider to be the decree mentioned by Gabriel. The second one is a decree made by King Darius in 520 BC. We read of that in Ezra 6, verses 1 through 3, and then verses 6 and 7.
Then Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in Babylon in the house of the archives, where the documents were stored, and in Ecbatana, the citadel, that's in the province of Media, scroll was found on which this was written, a record. In the first year of Cyrus the king issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, the place where sacrifices were offered, and let its foundations be retained. Its height shall be 60 cubits, and its breadth 60 cubits. Now, therefore, Tantanai, governor of the province beyond the river Shetharbozane, and your associates, the governors who are in the province beyond the river, keep away. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews rebuild this house of God on its site.
Okay, then the third decree that was given around this general time frame was by King Artaxerxes in 457 BC, and that's in Ezra 7, 11 to 13.
Now this is the copy of the decree which King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe learned in the words of the commandments of the Lord, and his statutes are Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra, priest, the scribe of the Lord, the God of heavens, perfect peace, one peace, and now. And I have issued a decree that any of the people of Israel and their priests and the Levites in my kingdom who are willing to go to Jerusalem may go with you.
Now, I don't know if you noticed anything common in those first three decrees, but did you notice what they dealt with? What was the decree to do? Pick that up. It was to go back and rebuild the temple, rebuild the house of the Lord, okay? And so this is one of the objections to these three decrees, to saying that that's when this time period that Daniel or that Gabriel's talking about begins, because they're talking about going back and rebuilding the temple, but the words that Gabriel uses here talk about going back and rebuilding the city. And that actually happens a little bit later on. So that initial decree of Cyrus specifically mentioned the temple, and the next two are kind of following on and reinforcing that first decree of Cyrus. Well, then the decree of Artaxerxes in 445 BC, we read of that in Nehemiah 2, verses 1 through 8.
Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king said to me, what are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's grave, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I had given him a time. I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me, to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me that, and granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God.
So this decree by Artaxerxes, when Nehemiah comes, Nehemiah knows that there have been people back in Jerusalem trying to rebuild the temple. They've met a lot of opposition along the way, and Ezra, in the book of Ezra, talks about that. So Nehemiah's concern here is about going back and building the walls and building the city. So for that reason, I favor this fourth decree as being the one that kind of kicks off the period, but again, others have other opinions, and that's fine, but we're going to follow that through tonight and see where that leads us. Seems to make the most sense from a chronological standpoint. So Nehemiah received a report concerning Jerusalem at the beginning of his book, and we see that in Nehemiah 1, 1 through 3.
The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, now it happened in the month of Shivlev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel, that Hananiah, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. They said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are destroyed by fire.
So Nehemiah gets his status report about what's happening in Jerusalem. It's not good. And so he has this burden now to go back and rebuild the gates, rebuild the walls, and parts of the city. It said there that this was in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. And so we know that that was in 445 BC. So we can kind of peg that pretty well. Well, before we go and lay out the timeline, Gabriel tells Daniel what's going to happen. He says, first of all, the anointed one, that is Messiah, the prince, will come. Now the Hebrew word here is, I'll try not to butcher this, but I think it's something like Mashiach or Mashiach. It's from the verb that means to smear something on someone, or more precisely, to pour sacred oil on the head, to set someone apart with special authority. So that's where we get this idea that of the anointed one. It had to do with the anointing of oil. The first use of this word in conjunction with the king was in Hannah's prayer. Somebody has 1 Samuel 2, verse 10.
The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed.
So here we see this tying in with the king and the anointed. Later, David recognized that Saul was the Lord's anointed, if you remember this part of the story, where he wouldn't harm Saul because he wouldn't want to touch the Lord's anointed. That's in 1 Samuel 24, 6.
He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed.
Now, there's some Jewish sources that want to remove the messianic connotations from Daniel, and so they say this is merely a reference to King Cyrus, who in other places God calls his servant or his anointed. But the plain sense here tells us that this prince, the anointed one, is a clear reference to the first coming of Christ. We also see in verse 25 that the squares or plazas, some versions use the word plazas, the squares and the moats will be rebuilt. So a square is a reference to just what you would think, a city plaza or an open place where people would meet and gather. We see more of these in Europe maybe than we see in this country, but there are some places where there are city squares yet in this country. So people would meet there and civic activity would occur there. And of course the moat is that defensive trench that's built around the city to help with the defense. And sometimes the idea of the moat and the walls are kind of used in conjunction, or not quite interchangeably, but they're used together because they both represent this defensive structure around the city. So generally, the squares are a reference to the inner city, and then the moats are a reference to this outer defense, which would include the walls. So Jerusalem would be rebuilt, and it would happen in troubled times. We see one example of this in Ezra 4, 11 through 16.
This is the copy of the letter which they sent to him, to King Artaxerxes, your servants, the men in the region beyond the river. And now let it be known to the king that the Jews Greeks who came up from you have come up to us at Jerusalem. They are rebuilding the rebellious and evil city and are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now let it be known to the king that if the city is rebuilt and the walls are finished, they will not pay tribute, custom or toll, and it will damage the revenue of the kings. Now because we are in the service of the palace, and it is not fitting for us to see the king's dishonor, therefore we have sent and informed the king, so that a search may be made in the record books of your fathers, and you will discover in the record books and learn that the city is a rebellious city and damaging to kings and provinces, and that they have incited revolt within it in the past days. Therefore the city was laid waste. We inform the king that if the city is rebuilt and the walls finished as a result of you, you will have no possession in the province beyond the river.
So the Jews were making progress in rebuilding the city, but their enemies didn't want them to progress, so they made up stories, they made up lies about them and went and told the king. Said, hey king, these guys are not doing you any good. Well, then that ended up turning out very positively for the Jews. But this is an example of some of the opposition that was going on during that time, as Gabriel tells Daniel here. So the enemies of the Jews were trying to get them to stop building the wall, and Nehemiah 4:15-18 describes again this opposition they encounter when they're rebuilding the city.
When our enemies heard that we knew of their plans and that God had frustrated them, we all returned to our work on the wall. But from then on, only half my men worked while the other half stood guard with spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. The officers stationed themselves behind the people of Judah who were building the wall. The common laborers carried on their work with one hand supporting their load and one hand holding a weapon. All the builders had a sword belted to their side. The trumpeter stayed with me to sound the alarm.
So Gabriel tells Daniel that the squares and the moats will be rebuilt, but they'll be rebuilt in times of distress. And we see here from these accounts in Ezra and Nehemiah that that's exactly what did happen. So God is telling Daniel through Gabriel when the Messiah will come. Remember in verse 19, Daniel prayed for an answer for his people and his city. So these words are first and foremost directed to the Jews and Jerusalem. So when will the Messiah come to his people? Gabriel says it will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now, the ESV translation here is a little misleading in this verse. Without getting too deep into the weeds, the ESV relied on some Masoretic texts that were written between 500 and 1100 AD. And in these documents, they add an accent in this verse. And so the ESV translators decided that meant they should put a period into the middle of the sentence. And the RSV followed the same practice. And that simple change gives us some issues, and we'll take a look at that. So let's look again at that last verse in verse 25, and I put it up here on the overhead. Here it is in the ESV and the RSV and a few other versions. It reads like this. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there will be 7 weeks. And for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. So, when does the anointed one come? When you read that verse, what's it sound like? When does the anointed one come?
In a troubled time.
Okay, in a troubled time.
Oh, 62 weeks.
7 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, the way it reads there is that there's 7 weeks and then the anointed one comes. So then how much time elapses after that? 62 weeks, right? And then what happens during that second period, according to this? Yeah, rebuild the squares and most, it'll be a troubled time, okay? So this, the reading of this, because it's a period right there after 7 weeks, it really gives us the idea that the anointed one's coming after 7 weeks, right? Okay. So let's take a look at this now in, I picked the NIV, but the New American Standard and Legacy Bible, there are many other translations, King James, many others, have this kind of a reading. We'll see the difference here. So you are to know and understand that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with streets and moats, even in times of distress. Okay, when does the Messiah come?
69.
After 69 weeks, yeah. And when is the rebuilding happening?
After 7 weeks.
It's not really clear, is it? Right? I mean, the rebuilding is sometime during that time period. It's not really as specific. We think it's happening during those first 7 weeks, but again, we're not going to be dogmatic about that. But you see the difference putting that period in there made? It just changed the whole timing of that event. So, you know, we don't want to criticize translators too much because they have an extremely difficult job. There's so many complications there. But in this one, it makes a big difference. I think maybe the other translations, I think, are preferable in this case. Because the ESV indicates that the streets and moats are being built over those last 62 weeks. And that just doesn't jive with anything that went on. Okay. So we see then Messiah will come 69 weeks after the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now it's not clear why there's this distinction between the 7 weeks and the 62 weeks. Some people have suggested in those first 7 weeks, which again is 49 years, right? Seven units of 7 years. So some say that's when the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem took place. And that's possible. We don't have anything in scripture from secular history that verify that, but it seems reasonable. So the total length of the 69 weeks to Messiah is important. Now, there are four major views of how we interpret this time frame, and there are probably untold nuances within each view. So I want to try to give you a high level of what some of these views are, and so that you're kind of informed of what they look like. So the first view is called the Maccabean view, and this view believes that the 69 weeks, or actually the 70 weeks, begin when the Babylonian captivity begins. And it carries on through until the time of Judas Maccabeus and when Antiochus Epiphanes is defiling the temple and then Judas Maccabeus defeats him, okay? This Maccabean view really tries to take any kind of messianic importance out of Daniel. It's denying that there's any talk of Messiah there. Some Jewish groups would hold to this view. Second view is called the preterist view. We encountered this word preterist when we were in Luke because some had a preterist view of the Olivet Discourse. And in this view, they recognized the beginning of the 70 weeks as being when Cyrus issued his decree to go back and allow the people to go back and begin rebuilding the temple. So to them, the 7 plus 62 weeks does culminate around the time of Christ. I think they probably say either his birth or maybe his baptism. But they see it there. And then they see the final 70 weeks as being accomplished by the time that the temple is destroyed in 70 AD. So again, it's a back-looking view. It's saying that all this has been accomplished. It's all over and done with. And that 70th week is a little fluid, right? It's a little long. It's not truly the 49 years, a little longer period of time. The third major view is called the covenantal view, or sometimes it's called a reformed view. Here again, they believe that the 69 weeks begin with a decree of Cyrus in 538 BC. It ends with Christ, the time of the end of his life, the triumphal entry. And then they see the 70th week is really just symbolic language. They see it's a metaphor for the age in which we now live. And so that 70th week will end when Christ returns. And as you might imagine, this is a view that amillennialists would have, because they're not looking toward a millennium. And the fourth view is a dispensational view. And this view says that the 69 weeks began when Artaxerxes issued his command to go and rebuild the city. It ended on the day of the triumphal entry, when Jesus went into Jerusalem. And then dispensationalists believe then there's a gap in time. And there are some indications of that, and Daniel will address that here in a minute. And then dispensationalists say that at some point in the future, there will be a 70th week, or a 7-year period of time, referred to as the tribulation. Some only refer to the last half as the Great Tribulation. Others would refer to the entire 7 years of the tribulation. And then there's an event in the middle of that week, and we'll read about that in Daniel, where the Antichrist breaks his compact. Now, having said this, there are all kinds of flavors within this, right? We're not even talking about the rapture. There's some people that believe the rapture is before, in the middle, and after the tribulation. Others, dispensationalists, would say, well, no, it didn't kick off with Artaxerxes. It kicked off at some different time. So there are, I don't know how many versions. There's a wide variety of feeling. But just in general, these are the four major approaches, each with their own individual nuances within them. We're going to focus on the last view, because we think that makes the most sense. That's what we adhere to at ICC, and so that's kind of what we're going to be heading toward. So I'm going to mention a book that was written back in the 1800s. An Englishman, Sir Robert Anderson, wrote a book entitled The Coming Prince. And he did an extensive study of this 62 weeks and going back in history and trying to find some dates. Well, in the 1970s, another scholar, Dr. Harold Honer, he led him to a slightly different beginning and ending date, but he arrived at a similar conclusion. Now, there's a lot of room to critique this work, and so we're going to approach it cautiously and humbly, but it has been regarded by a lot of scholars as authoritative, and so we're going to I'll present it to you, and then we can talk about it. As I said, there is room to critique it, because calendars and dates going back a couple thousand years are a little murky sometimes, and so there's room for some critiques here. I think the point is, it does appear that the Jews should have known the time of the first advent of Messiah. I think there was a way for them to understand the time that he was going to come. So here's a brief summary of what Anderson said in his book. So first of all, he says that the year is 360 days because the Jews were observing a lunar calendar. So a lunar month being about 30 days, 12 months, 360 days. He uses the term prophetic year. Now, some people criticize that idea of a prophetic year because we don't see that other places, but that's what he's using. So he has 360 days in a year. There are these 7 years, and then there's 7 years in one of these Daniel's weeks, right? Because a week is seven years per Daniel, and then there are 69 weeks. So 360 days times 7 years times 69 weeks is 170,880 days. I did warn there was going to be math, didn't I? Okay. Maybe not this much. You got your calculator? Good.
Yeah, I came exactly out.
Okay, well, thank you. Good. So then his second point is that Nehemiah 2, we read this earlier, says that the decree of Artaxerxes was issued in the 20th year in the month of Nisan. Well, Anderson uses the 1st of Nisan, or March 14th, and as we said, 445 was that 20th year of Artaxerxes. Well, then he jumps and he says, well, he doesn't address when Christ was born. Rather, he says, if we go to Luke, Luke tells us that John the Baptist begins his ministry, and so Jesus also begins his ministry, in the 15th year of Tiberius. Well, that would be 29 AD. We can be pretty confident of that. And then he says that Jesus' final Passover celebration then would have been in 32 AD. And so the Sunday before that Passover, that triumphal entry, would have been on April 6th or 7th of 32 AD. And then he wraps it up here. So he takes the time between March 14th, 445, and April 7th in 32 AD. He adds in some days for leap years, and then for this time from March to April, and he comes up with that same number, 173,888. Okay? So again, a lot of people have, you know, tried to critique this and criticize it, but I think it bears at least laying it out there that somebody went to the effort and was able to reconcile this down to the day.
The triumphal entry, wasn't that the end of the covenant? Wasn't that the actual end of the covenant of the Jewish, when the leaders rejected
him? Well, they've rejected their Messiah at that point.
And
that's why it's significant that it's that day and not the crucifixion, for example. It's that
that's
day.
What I'm trying to say.
Yeah. That's the day. Well, I think I'm going to talk about a second here. So when Jesus enters in Jerusalem, he's presenting himself to his people as their Messiah. If you'll recall, up until now, they've tried to acclaim him a king and elevate him, and he's just shut them down. He said, no, my time has not yet come. Well, now he's presenting himself as Messiah, and we see this in Luke 19, 35 to 38.
As he was going, they were spreading their coats on the road. As soon as he was approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen, shouting, Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.
So Jesus gathers his great acclaim on that day as he enters Jerusalem. And as he did it, he's fulfilling the prophecy in Zechariah 9 through 10.
Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, a foal of a donkey. I will cut off the chariot of Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth.
So Jesus fulfills the messianic prophecy because he enters the city on the colt of a donkey. And this was the manner that a king would enter the city when they were coming in peace. They'd ride on their war horse when they were coming in battle. But they came on the colt of a donkey, and we saw David do this. He put Solomon on a donkey and had him enter as he comes in peace. So again, up to this point, Jesus put off the attempts to make him king, but this day he openly enters Jerusalem as the Messiah, and when he's criticized, remember he says, well, if they didn't shout, even the rocks would shout and cry out. This is his day. So there will be 69 weeks from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem to the coming of the Anointed One, a prince. Once the 69 weeks ended, there are other events that would take place that Gabriel tells Daniel here. And it's important to note the timing in verse 26. It speaks of these events taking place after the 69th week. And this is why the dispensationalist view says there's a gap. There are things that are happening between week 69 and week 70. So we believe there's evidence of that here in this word from Gabriel to Daniel. It doesn't say these events are going to happen in the 70th week or to kick off the 70th week. So there's a strong argument for this position that there's a gap between week 69 and week 70. So it says that the anointed one shall be cut off and have nothing. This is a reference to the crucifixion. The Messiah would be rejected. He was cut off from man and from life. And on the cross, he indicated he was forsaken of God. Somebody has Matthew 27, 45 to 50.
At noon, darkness fell across the whole land till 3 o'clock. At about 3 o'clock, Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Some of the bystanders misunderstood and thought he was calling out for the prophet Elijah. One of them ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, holding it up to him on a stick so he could drink. But the rest said, "Leave him alone. Let's see whether Elijah will come and save him." Then Jesus shouted out again, and he gave up the spirit.
All right, so after the 69 weeks are over, Messiah will be cut off. Gabriel goes on to say that the city and the sanctuary will be destroyed. This verse says that the people of the prince that is to come would destroy the city and the sanctuary. Gabriel here is prophesying what we know from history, that the Romans would destroy the city of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. The Romans here are called the people of the prince. The prince who is to come that Gabriel is now talking about is a different prince. This prince who is to come is the Antichrist. Daniel also called this prince the rather small horn and the king of bold face. He will later refer to him as a contemptible person. Zechariah called him a worthless shepherd, Zechariah 11, 16 and 17.
Being destroyed, or seek the young, or heal the maimed, or nourish the healthy, but devours the flesh of the fat ones, tearing off even their hooves. Woe to my worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. Let his arm be wholly withered and his right eye utterly blinded.
Paul describes this Antichrist in 2 Thessalonians 2, 3 and 4.
"Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God."
Paul calls him the man of lawlessness, the son of destruction, who's going to take God's place in the temple. And then John talks about him in the Revelation, Revelation 11, 7.
"When they finished their testimony, the beast that sent out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them."
So John simply refers to him as the beast. So Gabriel gives us another biblical reference to the Antichrist coming from a revived Roman Empire in this verse. Well, then it says there will be floods, wars, and desolations. We know the Jews have certainly experienced a steady stream of war and desolations over the years, from the medieval Crusades to the Spanish Inquisition to Russian pogroms, Nazi Holocaust, and there's even rising anti-Semitism in our own day. All this happens in that gap between Daniel's 69th and 70th week, which, by the way, also corresponds to what we call the church age. This is the time of Gentiles coming into the kingdom. So consider Paul's words in light of this passage in Daniel, where Paul talks in Ephesians 3, 2 through 10.
If indeed you have heard of this stewardship of God's grace, which was given to me for you, that by revelation there is made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in brief. By referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ, which in other generations was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to his holy apostles and prophets in the Spirit. To be specific, that the Gentiles are fellow heirs and fellow members of the body and fellow partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel, of which I was made a minister according to the gift of God's grace, which was given to me according to the working of his power. To me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given, to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ, and to bring to light that which is the administration of the mystery, which for ages has been hidden in God who created all things, so that the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known through the church and to the rulers and the authorities in the heavenly places.
So this gap between weeks 69 and 70 is a wonderful time of salvation being extended to the Gentiles and the church and the mysteries that go along with that. Well, there's one more event that ends this gap and begins, actually kicks off the 70th week. Verse 27 says, a covenant will be established. He shall make a covenant. Now, some think that this is a reference to either Christ or Antiochus Epiphanes, but a straightforward reading here shows that the he here is the prince who is to come, or the Antichrist. We're not given any details about the covenant, but it is with the many. Remember, this vision is for Daniel's people and Daniel's city. So the many here are the apostate Jews in the latter days. So this may be some kind of a peace treaty, or maybe a statement of religious freedom, or an agreement to protect Israel. We don't really know for sure. Take a look at 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3.
And sudden destruction will come upon them, as labor pains come upon pregnant women, and they will not escape.
So the suggestion there is that when that end comes, there may have been a time of peace, people calling for peace, so maybe this covenant that the Antichrist signs has something to do with peace or some tolerance for the Jews, but that comes to an end. The covenant marks the beginning of the 70th week, which is also referred to as the tribulation. Some would say that only the last half of those 7 years is the Great Tribulation. Generally, the whole seven are referred to in that way. So the covenant, though, that the Antichrist signs will be short-lived. In the middle of the seven-year period, the Antichrist turns on the Jews, and he will put an end to the daily sacrifices and offerings. Well, we can reason from this that at some point before the middle of the 70th week, the temple in Jerusalem will be rebuilt and the sacrifices will be reinstituted, because it says here that he's stopping those sacrifices. So the reasoning is that the temple is back on, the sacrifices are back on. It says that the word wing is used here. The meaning is a little bit unclear, but it may refer to a portion or a wing of the temple. It's not really clear. But the word abominations is clear enough. The Hebrew word for abominations means disgusting, filthy, detestable. It's a term for anything that is detestable to God, and is particularly applied to idol worship. The Septuagint translates this Hebrew word, and it used a word that means emitting a foul odor. So you get the idea of the unpleasantness of this word. The Antichrist will put himself in the place of God, and it is revolting to God. It will be a time of great terror. Well, there will be a decreed end. The 70th week will come to an end, and the Antichrist will be destroyed. We saw this before in Daniel 7, verse 11.
And given over to the burned, to be burned with fire.
And then John writes of this also in Revelation 19:20.
And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet, who in presence has done the signs by which he deceived those who have received the mark of the beast and those who worship its image. Two were thrown.
So as we said, this passage in Daniel gives us the backbone, the outline of prophecy. It's later going to be added to by John the Apostle and Paul and others. Jesus himself will add to it in his speaking. But we can be encouraged by the parts of these prophecies that have already come to pass. And we can have faith that God is sovereign and in control, as we've seen throughout Daniel, and he'll bring this all about to his righteous conclusion. So let's think of a couple applications here. What do we see about God in this passage?
I think some people might think this kind of stuff is not very practical as far as like my Christian life is concerned, you know, like marriage is falling apart, or my kids are all out of whack, or, you know, just name it. And the idea that all of these prophecies and stuff, like, that's all great and good, but how's that helping me to, like, you know, fix my life or my situation? And I think the problem with that thinking is God's point in a lot of this is to be very, very, like, enamored of God, to think that he is very powerful and sovereign, that he's in control of these things, that he would be like bigger than your problems. Not to say that you should ignore your wife and your kids and responsibilities, but just that when you come into them, it's with this idea that you have a relationship with this God, and there's a perspective or humility I need to have because I know this God. And he's the kind of God that has set these things out from the beginning, that causes the rise and fall of nations and all these things. That's why you need to know this stuff, if you want to put it that way. It's because it changes you. You knowing who God is and what kind of God he is, it should change how you approach your wife or your kids or difficult circumstances. And if you have just a very small God who's just there to be your buddy and help you get through life or something, then sometimes his advice is not practical. It's like, lay down your life. Well, why is he worth that? If my friend told me as an average advice, when you need to lay down your life and follow me, I just find another friend. You know, and if God is one of many people that I just need life help or, you know, like therapy from, that's not to downplay, you know, therapy or counseling. It's just, you know, what am I saying really about the value God has in my life, that he's only there just to help me get through stuff? Well, yes, but not by being a better friend than, you know, my buddy I've known forever. It's by being God. And so this is really important to help us have a really big view of God, that he's worthy of worshiping and being humble before and fearing and serving. So I see that, because I can imagine someone, you know, going through some hard trial, you know, someone calls me on the phone and, you know, they've got a real bad disease or, you know, economic, financial issues, and like, would I dare to say, you know, that what I learned in Bible study last night was about the 70 weeks of Daniel, and I can just, you know, we did the math, and just like them, like saying, what does this have to do? You need to tell me how I can fix this issue. Well, not that I would necessarily do the math lesson, but just, you know, God is in control. Like, this was written 2,000 something years ago. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's doing. You trust him? You know him? Mm-hmm. If you don't know him and trust him, why not? Like, what do you think is going on here in your life? Is he just your I think it's important. It's all very important.
One of the things that kind of jumped out at me is because it is so specific in detail, we are able to look back at history and say, well, that actually happened. We're doing that tonight. We're putting a date on it and saying, here are the four options. It was probably the Artaxerxes date. But so we can look at that through the lens of history and say, God knew what was going to go on when he gave this to Daniel before it happened. And it happened, but obviously we haven't finished the story. But he gives us the rest of the story, so we should trust that.
I think we've hit the second question already. How can we live with hope? And how might this prophecy shape our character and long-term perspective? Well, to the extent that it grows our vision of God, it's absolutely going to help those things.
Don't make predictions about when the rapture is, though. That's not an application.
Yeah, that's... thank you. Yeah, that's not an application. Okay, anything you have to say before we go? All right. Okay, let me pray and we'll be dismissed. Lord, thank you for this time in Daniel tonight and for these words that you sent through Gabriel to Daniel to encourage him and encourage us as well. We get a growing vision of how great you are. Your sovereignty, your control over kings and over history, over the future. And it does grow our faith. It does encourage us. So thank you for that tonight, Lord. I pray that you keep us safe as we travel home and bless the rest of our week. In Jesus' name.